The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. This week, we're going to take you back in time. Yes, we've discovered a use for those faster-than-light neutrinos that physicists found earlier in the year. We're using them to take you back through the Science Weekly archive for 2011. You're a little early, I hear you say. That's not the neutrinos' fault, but it's because next week we have a special show dedicated to the neuroscientist Professor Bruce Hood, who's conducting this year's Royal Institution Christmas Lectures. More on that next week. But for now, let's look back to 2011. And what a year it's been. From the last flight of the space shuttle to orgasms in a brain scanner. From the conundrum of dark matter to the nature of evil in humans. And why violence in human societies seems to be on the decline. We've discovered dozens of new planets, including one that sort of looks like Earth. We've pondered why the Germans are so good at science. And of course, particle physics got caught in the spin of spin, and all the more interesting for it. This is the 2011 end-of-year edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. Now, every year we try and kick off with a bang. And who better to kick 2011 off with than the venerable physicist Stephen Hawking? It might not have come as a surprise to his many science fans, but wait for it, he announced that there was no heaven. And by inference, no God either. The Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample spoke to the great man himself.
It was actually quite important for me because it was it's one of those interviews that of course you want to interview Stephen Hawking if you're a science journalist, and if you don't, it's kind of odd. I really loved the opportunity. It was a shame that you only get to, you know, do this kind of thing by email. You get a limited number of questions. It's not like you can sit there and have a chat, and you can't ask any follow-up questions, and you can't get into the depth of things. So you inevitably end up with your answers being kind of soundbite.
So tell us what you asked him.
So the question that caused all the fuss was a question that came from the fact that he was in hospital, and he was very ill in 2009, and there was sort of a lot of concern over whether he was going to make it through at that point. And the question was simply whether he was afraid of death, and he sent us this answer.
I have lived with the prospect of an early death for the last 49 years. I'm not afraid of death, but I'm in no hurry to die. I have so much I want to do first. I regard the brain as a computer, which will stop working when its components fail. There is no heaven or afterlife for broken down computers. That is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark.
That was Professor Stephen Hawking answering your question, Ian, about whether he was afraid of death. And clearly, without prompting, he brought in this idea of heaven and God, and this created a storm on our website, hundreds of thousands of views on that article, thousands of comments, and all sorts of Twitter sort of stuff. It was kind of expected, I suppose.
I think it always is. And you know, part of you thinks, why is this so popular? Why is this so red? Why has this become such a big fuss? Because I think that there are many people who don't believe there's God or an afterlife or a heaven. And
many people who know that Stephen Hawking doesn't believe that too.
And I think people are interested in how he feels about things and how he felt about that close shave in 2009. So I think there is a genuine interest in just what this guy makes of things.
Stephen Hawking is just one of the many scientists, philosophers and authors who have vocally or physically wandered into the Science Weekly studios this year. And remember, the beauty of podcasting is that everything you hear is still available at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Back in May, the Cambridge University autism specialist Simon Baron-Cohen came in to discuss human evil with Ian Sample and why he thinks that cruelty is just one end of the scale of human behaviour. Professor Baron-Cohen explained to Ian how a horrific story about Nazi cruelty led him to a lifelong study of empathy and the need for science to understand acts of cruelty.
You opened the book with some quite striking discussions with your father as when you were a child. And I wonder if you could just tell us about those and whether there were any influence on your interest in this area.
Sure. The passage that you're referring to in my book is when my father told me when I was about 7 years old that the Nazis had turned Jews into lampshades. And just listening to that phrase, the idea of turning a person into an object, is something that stuck with me as a child. He also told me, you know, other stories about what the Nazis did to different minorities. But the commonality seemed to be that when human beings act in a cruel way, they treat other people as objects. But for me, what's nagged away at me all these years and now decades is how can human beings turn off their empathy, their compassion for a fellow human being, so that they can just treat them as an object? And as a neuroscientist, I also am interested to know what's going on in the brain when we can lose our feelings, our compassion for somebody else, and do awful things.
You talk about there being this sort of historical problem where there's no good explanation for what evil and cruelty really are, even though we recognise them when we see them. I mean, has this area been neglected by science? Has it left it to religious and other domains?
I think religion has tried to explain acts of cruelty for centuries, so they've had a head start on science.
Now it's time we took a journey into space. This year brought with it a stupendous haul of newly discovered planets outside our solar system. Using space probes such as Kepler, astronomers found a planet that orbits two suns. Yep, a bit like that planet in Star Wars where Luke Skywalker grew up. And most recently, Kepler-22b. This is a planet that is apparently a lot like Earth. It's 2.4 times the size of Earth and has a balmy 22 degrees Celsius surface temperature. But it's 600 light years from here, and no one's quite sure yet if it's made mostly of rock, gas, or liquid. Closer to home, the space shuttle took its 135th and last flight this year. It marked the end of an era for human spaceflight and raised questions about what NASA does next with its astronauts. We decided to give Atlantis, Discovery, Endeavour, Challenger, Columbia, and Enterprise our very own tribute.
Solid rocket booster separation confirmed. Guidance now converging. Onboard computers commanding the main engine nozzles to swivel, aiming the shuttle for its precise target in space for main engine cutoff.
Hammering log of Mach 3, 25,000 feet per second or so, and you watch the counter come down. There's a little arrow that moves from right to left on the instrument in front of you. The clock's down the last 10 seconds before main engine cutoff, MECO. And at that second, you hear a bang. Engines cut off. And you go from 3G to 0G in a fraction of a second. So from being shoved back in your seat and not really able to move at all, to you floating forward and bouncing around your straps and everything else in the cockpit that's sort of unrestrained starts floating around too. And there you are in 0G, scooting around above the Earth. It happens instantaneously. And you're ready for it, but it's still always a bit of a surprise, and everyone's laughing at that point. It's such fun.
It's not time to take your spacesuits off quite yet. We know that regular Science Weekly listeners like to have their minds expanded, and there's nothing more mentally expanding than the subject of dark matter. In September of this year, we ventured to Bradford for the British Science Festival, and there we met Durham University's Carlos Frank.
most of the material in the galaxies has to be dark because we don't see it, and it is exactly the agent responsible for, it's sort of the glue that keeps the galaxies together. But we also have other evidence, actually, for dark matter, because dark matter not only keeps galaxies in place, dark matter also interferes with the propagation of light in the universe in a very peculiar way. It causes light emitted from very distant galaxies to be deflected as it goes near concentrations of dark matter, producing the phenomenon of gravitational lensing that has been observed with the Hubble Space Telescope, whereby the images of distant galaxies are distorted into arc-like features. And this gravitational lensing effect is the smoking gun for dark matter, together with the fact, of course, that galaxies exist and that they require the dark matter to keep them in place.
So we know it's there. We know it's dark. So what do scientists look for when trying to identify what this stuff might be?
Most important property of dark matter is that it is not ordinary matter. So we've known for a long time that whatever it is not made of ordinary atoms. For the last 30 or 35 years, scientists have worked on the hypothesis that the dark matter is some form of elementary particle, distinct from the elementary particles that make the atoms. And we've been working for many years on a very specific proposal, which is very attractive, very elegant, namely that the dark matter is a kind of particle known as supersymmetric particles. These are particles that, if they exist, would have been produced when the universe was very young, just about a millionth of a second old, when at these very high energies that prevailed at that time, there were symmetries between different classes of elementary particles called supersymmetries. And when the universe cooled down and these symmetries disappeared, they left behind the so-called supersymmetric particles that have yet to be discovered, but would have been generated in abundance, in profusion at that early time, and could in principle be the dark matter. This idea really took hold because it was immensely successful in explaining a vast range of astronomical observations. So what we do in this subject, and that's what I particularly like to do, is to do simulations of how the universe evolved. In these simulations, we have to instruct the supercomputer with the laws of physics, also tell a large supercomputer what the dark matter is. And if you ask the computer to give you a virtual universe in which the dark matter is one of the supersymmetric particles, it comes out with some really, really realistic universes that resemble the real one in many, many details. But as we are discovering now, not in every detail.
From dark matter to matters in the dark, from cosmology to the female orgasm. At the annual meeting of the American Society for Neuroscience this year, the most talked about story, oh, and this is really a surprise, was the science of the female orgasm, specifically a brain scan of a woman in the process of having one. There were lots of other fascinating neuroscience stories in that edition, well worth checking out, but we thought we'd play to your basest instincts.
So this was a bit of research from a psychologist at Rutgers University, and he demonstrated what he said he was pretty sure was the first animation built up from fMRI scan images of a woman having an orgasm in an fMRI scanner. And he says the point of this is that if you can look second by second at what is going on in the female brain when an orgasm happens, can you then compare that kind of, you learn a lot about the connectivity of the brain, he would argue. And can you then compare that to women who might have anorgasmia, as they call it? I'm not sure how very common that is, but anyway, can you compare it to people who have problems with that to see what's going wrong? And can it become, in some sense, you know, steer your clinical direction?
And so is there any physiological purpose to it beyond sort of just understanding how the brain works?
Well, I say, I mean, really what he wants to do is, first of all, can you identify what part of the brain comes in when? And then when, you know, which pieces are then working simultaneously? How does activity build up and then come together for your crescendo moment? But he is already looking at comparing those scans with, he's also got male orgasm scans to compare with men who've had prostates removed from prostate cancer to look at why they're not having orgasms. which I must admit you'd imagine you could get from other ways because you know what nerves you've damaged when you've done that operation. I thought, maybe not. And he's looking at women who've, say, had hysterectomies to see for, you know, similar issues. What is different in their brains when they try and have an orgasm if they can't have an orgasm? I think there's another stage to this as to that's a bit more questionable as to whether you can use this to get anywhere. Can you use this to really help people? He thinks, you know, you can do that by getting people to try and change their brain activity themselves by seeing it themselves. But I don't know how effective it is.
Now, if any listeners want to know how long it takes to practice how to have an orgasm in an MRI scanner, you can go to our blog where Kate Sukel, who's a journalist, actually did this for a piece of research and has written about it. If that's left your heart racing, then let's think about that for a bit. For a brief period, we went heart crazy here at Science Weekly, making 4 videos and an entire podcast about one of our most beautiful, most written about, and most fascinating organs, the heart. We spoke to Oxford University biologist Paul Riley on how you go about repairing damage to hearts.
So our work really came about through developmental biology. We were very interested in how the heart is formed, and we were interested in how the epicardial cells can give rise to the coronary blood vessels and potentially to the heart muscle. And what we did was basically we identified that these cells still exist in the adult heart, but they're effectively inactive, they're effectively dormant. So from early stages after birth, they switch off their activity. It's now known that they may actually contribute a low number of cells during heart function over a lifetime, and that's actually being explored in detail as we speak by us and other groups. But the important point was they were dormant, they were effectively asleep. And what we did was we wanted to reactivate those cells, and we wanted a measure of how we had reactivated them. And the key point there was we needed some means to label these cells. So we used a mouse model whereby we had a transgenic mouse which had a green fluorescent protein driven by a particular gene. And this gene is switched on during development in these cells, but switched off in the adult. So what we thought is if we use a mechanism to stimulate these cells, this gene will be switched back on, turn the cells green, and we can follow what they do. And now means to reactivate them was this protein called thymosin beta-4, plus the actual injury event itself. So we treated animals with thymosin beta-4, which is a small peptide known to stimulate cell movement and has been shown to sort of reactivate potentially these cells. And we injured the animals at the same time. So a combination of pre-treatment with thymosin beta-4, injury, giving the animals an infarction, a myocardial infarction, combined enabled us to watch what these cells did. They turned on this green fluorescent protein. They then migrated into the area of injury, and they formed smooth muscle cells, fibroblasts, and also cardiomyocytes, the muscle of the heart.
Earlier in the year, we took Science Weekly on the road, all the way to Germany. As well as visiting Berlin's Natural History Museum and the gravity-defying drop tower in Zaum, we paid a visit to Europe's version of ground control. In Darmstadt, the European Space Agency watches its launches and controls all its satellites and probes. Among the space scientists on the premises was Dr. Holger Krag, whose job it is to monitor the ever-growing cloud of junk that orbits the Earth and can put astronauts and satellites in grave danger.
Okay, I'll be supposed to be. My name is Holger Krag. I'm what we call a space debris analyst, working in ESA's space debris office here in Darmstadt, in European Space Operations Center.
In these boxes, there's samples of tests demonstrating basically the energy inside objects going around Earth. So this is,
Now, I was expecting when we were told we're going to come to a space debris office to literally be in a junkyard of some sort with bits of space station and satellite. We're actually in a quite a tidy office. Tell us what the space debris department does.
Well, I did not show you my office yet, and I won't. Since we are attached to an operational department here, we are looking at the safety of our satellites, and this means we are monitoring close conjunctions between our satellites and other objects that orbit the Earth. And nowadays situation, we have more or less weekly warnings for our satellites, which means we have to take or at least consider counteractions like avoidance maneuvers.
And so these bits of satellites and bits of equipment, how fast are they traveling? What's their potential danger?
Very fast. In order to stay in orbit, an object in these altitudes must move with 7 kilometers per second. So you can imagine that we have collision velocities of up to 14 kilometers per second, so twice that number in head-on cases. And with these velocities, even a small, tiny object of just cherry size will reveal an energy comparable to a grenade exploding.
Now, you've brought some things in from your debris office. Take us through what we have. There's a lump of aluminium here which looks slightly mangled. What's happened to it?
It was the victim of a ground test that was done close to here in Freiburg by the Ernst Mach Institute, and they have what we call a light gas gun. So this is a special gun that has a capability to accelerate objects up to 6 kilometers per second. So this is not quite the velocity that we have up there, but it's coming close. And they accelerated a sphere of 1 centimeter diameter. I have it in my hand here. It's an aluminium ball. And this was shot onto this aluminium plate. It's a very thick plate of about 10 centimeter thickness. And you can see that it punched a crater of about 5 centimeter deepness. And you even see that we have some spallation effects on the other side, so even the other side is somehow affected. The shockwave went through and separated some materials on the other side. The real sphere, of course, that's not available anymore. That was pulverized and became liquid and disappeared in droplets and gaseous form. And of course, you can imagine that if you hold this is a couple of kilograms, you cannot equip your spacecraft with walls like that. So it shows we have a problem. Even small bullets like this 1 centimeter sphere, of which we have 600,000 up there, they cannot be shielded with such kind of thing. Still, we need to do something in order to protect manned modules in particular, where astronauts stay in, like the ISS, the International Space Station. And here, engineers developed something clever, we call it a double shield or Whipple shield. Whipple is an American scientist who developed this kind of shield. And he came up with the idea, why don't we use the energy of the object in order to destroy it? This is done by just exposing a very, very thin aluminium plate to the environment outside, which is sacrificed and which is punched. But at the same time, the object is also destroyed and translated into a number of very small liquid droplets. And this cloud of liquid droplets can then easily be stopped by a second plate, which is just behind, 5-6 centimeters behind, and not very thick. And if you hold this, it's very lightweight. This is a couple of grams. And this is something you can use in space. And actually, space station and also the ATV, they are equipped with this kind of protection shields.
From the violence of space to a more earthly incarnation of this aspect of life. Human violence was the topic of conversation when I met the celebrated Harvard University psychologist, Steven Pinker. His latest book argues that violence is on the decline. He holds that we're all living in the most peaceful time in human history. Well, relatively speaking. Never mind the stats on murders and bludgeonings, though. When I met Professor Pinker, I wanted to know about the neuroscience. What causes violence, and is there some physiological pointer to why we're so much less violent than our axe-wielding ancestors seem to be? You talk about the cognitive, perhaps the potential cognitive bases for it, and there's some really interesting new research going on into things like oxytocin, the hormone, the cuddle chemical,
yes.
And mirror neurons and things, which are both a mechanism in the brain to allow you to sort of feel kinship and warmth towards people. How much do we really know whether that's a real thing or whether it's just sort of tempting to think that it somehow exists in the brain, that there's a sort of empathy bit to your brain?
Yes. Mirror neurons are probably a red herring. They probably have nothing to do with empathy in the sense of compassion or sympathetic concern.
And these are neurons which are directed to copying behavior or feeling the same feelings as something, someone or something that you're looking at?
Probably. What we know about them literally is simply that they fire either when the animal executes a particular motion, like grasping, or when it sees another animal executing that action. It's been extrapolated to empathy, although the extrapolation is dubious. I think a better candidate is the oxytocin system, which does seem to correlate with various warm and cuddly and compassionate feelings. But there is reason to be skeptical of how much empathy powered the large-scale declines of violence. Because our sense of empathy, though it can be expanded, and there are experiments showing that if you read someone else's first-person account or listen to them, you then are more sympathetic to that person and the category of that that person represents. How strong those effects are is another story. And by default, our sense of empathy is triggered by cute little babies and fuzzy animals and our spouse and our brothers and sisters and our mothers. It can be expanded, but there are certainly limits. On the other hand, reason, that is the realization that there's nothing special about me, and whether or not I feel the pain of someone starving or being hacked to death in some remote part of the world, I know it's wrong. I know that it can't be justified. To get that going, you don't really have to feel their pain. You just have to know that it's indefensible to allow them to suffer. And the conclusion that I came to in the book, having reviewed the history of all of these declines, is that many of them were propelled more by reason than by empathy. Empathy can go only so far, but as you have a more rational, intellectualized society, there's some practices that just can no longer be justified. Not that empathy can't help the process along, but that it's ultimately reason and rationality that lead them to be eliminated.
The last part of this year was all about physics. In September, scientists at the Gran Sasso Laboratory in Italy found evidence that neutrinos, a type of subatomic particle, could apparently travel faster than the speed of light. This violates the special theory of relativity, developed by Albert Einstein, no less, a fundamental idea upon which most of modern physics is based. If the superluminal speed is proved correct, things get really sticky for modern physics. Time travel would turn out to be possible, and causality would be challenged. Effects could come before causes. Meanwhile, in December, scientists at CERN in Geneva picked up their first hints that the Higgs boson really does exist. The particle that's thought to give everything else mass, the Higgs boson was postulated in the 1960s, and it's taken CERN's Large Hadron Collider to reach the energies needed to produce it. Both experiments, of course, will be checked, replicated, and rechecked in 2012, before any results are confirmed. Whatever happens, though, it will be the start of a new era in physics. If you want to get an insight into the quantum mechanics involved, have a listen to our extended interview with John Butterworth. The Guardian blogger and professor of physics at University College London gave us his guide to the Higgs boson and the challenges of searching for new particles at the Large Hadron Collider.
As it gets lower, it can no longer decay to W's and Z's, and what it decays to then dominantly is a B quark, and you get jets made of B quarks, you get sprays of hadrons coming out, and the problem is the LHC has just is full of sprays of hadrons, so it's almost an impossible signal to find. So it takes a lot, although we'd be making a lot more Higgses then if it's low mass. It's a lot harder to find them. It's a needle in a haystack that's a lot smaller, and the haystack's a lot bigger in that case than it would be if it was heavier.
John, if the LHC or Tevatron come out at some point and say they have found a particle, how do you know whether it's the Higgs or something else? I mean, how do you know that, you know, the Higgs has different properties to other particles? How do you know, just from the fact that it decays into this, that and the other at different masses, how do you know that is actually then responsible for doing what the Higgs field does, if you like?
Well, the key element in that, well, first of all, it must have no charge and it must have spin zero and things, but those kind of things you can probably pin down at some point. But the key thing is what I was saying, it couples to mass. That's what it's for. It gives things mass. And the what we mean by coupling is it's the if you imagine it, you've made a Higgs and it's got an option to decay to a whole bunch of things. The coupling just tells it which, if the coupling's strong, it will decay to this. If it's weaker, it will decay to the other thing, something else less often. And it's measuring whether that coupling is what the standard model says it should be, which is basically going with the mass of the thing. And that's what I was saying, that you need to see this in several different channels
and with the frequencies you'd expect from
exactly the proportionate rates and everything. Exactly.
So that kind of becomes the fingerprint for the particle.
That's right.
You decide
right.
beforehand that's how it should look, and if it looks like that, then almost by definition.
I mean, in a way, you know, in science, it's very, very hard to prove positive. Right? So you'd always have some questions.
Well, that's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with all those breaking science news stories at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.